a green donut? Wasn't it your job to bring them, Representative Johnson?
No.
You're right. I mean, like, you're right.
The K-12 Education Committee will come to order. Welcome. This is St. Patrick's Day. And I see some people are wearing the green. There you go. All right. First fill up on the agenda, and we will be recessing till 4:30 today if we don't get through our bills. And we will be in room 5 this afternoon if we don't get through our bills, but maybe we will. House File 2285 is Representative Wardlow, and this is just a review. This was in policy, and we just want to have you review this. It will be before us for possible inclusion, and it does have a fiscal cost in the tails. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume that means you just moved my bill, House File 2285.
You may move it yourself.
There.
I do so.
All right.
And as I was sitting here, I was thinking I should have brought being a teacher, I should have brought an apple for everybody. And then I should have brought a green apple.
Yeah.
And I failed when I do it. Maybe I can bring one tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay. And you have a delete all amendments?
Yes, I do.
All right. So you want to move the DE3?
I'd like to move DE3.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right. Now you want to explain your...
Yes, ma'am. I have one oral amendment on page 2, line 8.
Don't start this again.
Change the number 15 to 20. St. Paul Schools suggested a period longer than 15 days, and we did. I agree.
So how is your delete all now different from the original bill that you presented?
Can I just go through the delete all and
yes,
that'll do it?
Yes, that's what I would like you to do.
This bill, if you look at lines 5 through 8, talks about schools only from kindergarten through grade 6, and it says they must consider retaining a student without promotion to the next grade level, whereas the old bill said they had to retain them. And three things have to happen at the same time. It's not either or, it's all the above. The student has to be enrolled for at least 120 days and be absent more than 20% of the time. The student has to achieve below grade level on test scores, statewide or district-wide assessments that are reliable. And the school has to determine that the student did not master the academic skills needed to move to succeed into the next grade. In addition to that, the school must provide differentiated instruction whether or not the student is retained in that same grade or promoted to the next grade level. And that accommodates the Excel program at St. Paul, and I understand Greg Marcus talked with Mary Gilbert, and they can live with this language, and that's why that's in there. There's a definition of differentiated instruction there. Elementary school teachers especially are very good at providing independent instruction for different kids within the classroom, and they're good at that. It might be the teacher doing it herself. It might be a class that has a co-teacher in it. Might be a totally separate class that's made for special needs students, academically needed students. Notice on line 24, it says, after meeting with the student's parent or guardian, the student's teacher or teachers, and the school principal or other appropriate administrator, the student's proposed retention will be discussed. So the parents involved in this meeting. And then the administrator must provide timely written notice to the student and the parent or guardian of the decision about whether to promote or retain the student. And then upon that decision, the parent has 20 days to make an appeal to the superintendent. And then the school superintendent must give a timely written notice to the student and the parent or guardian about that decision, and that decision is final. Students that are under an IEP or pupil of limited English proficiency are exempt from this, and the school board or charter school board must make some sort of retention policy and procedure that includes requirements under this section.
All right. Are there any questions about the bill? Representative Garling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Wardlaw. I'm wondering how many districts will change what they're doing as a result of this bill.
Probably, I bet you a lot of them are doing this already. What it does, it puts meat, statutory teeth into the fact that I know of principals who refuse to retain someone, and if they do retain them, they just keep them in the same old class, and you know they repeat the same class they had before and don't improve. And this, the principal can point to this statute and say there is reason for retention or at least promotion to differentiated instruction so that the kid can get a better education or have a better chance of understanding.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
why do you think if a principal refuses to retain anyone that this law will do anything about that?
A lot of principals are just afraid of the parent pressure and lawsuits. Lawyers come in and demand why their kid was held back.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Wardlaw, I think you've weakened your bill to the point where when you just, they have to consider it, but they don't have to do it, that it doesn't really accomplish anything. And I agree that it's better not to make that mandate because we don't have any money to go along with it for the intervention, the differentiated instruction, which I think is a good thing to couple with retention. But I think without the mandate, then I wonder why we would put this in the statute, unless the purpose is to have, if there's some other purpose that I'm missing here.
I understand your reasoning, and I kind of liked it before when it used to say, I'm sorry, when it used to say must, but also it says they must provide some sort of different instruction, whether they retain or promote. And I think that's a key element here. And sometimes they don't do that.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wardlaw. I'm looking for the accountability in here. You're requiring school districts, you say they must consider retaining a student without promotion to the next grade. Are you thinking that the Department of Education will come up with a standardized form, that they'll report each year the number of students that they have considered for retention, their rationale for those, you know, the grade, the absentee, the performance on tests, that sort of thing, and then report off not only the numbers that they've considered retention, maybe the numbers of parent meetings they've had, the numbers they have indeed retained, and then the academic success or not of those students?
Madam Chair?
Representative Wardlaw.
Good point. We had the reporting process in there. We took it out. Schools are already doing this internally anyway. And they do have a school board that watches over them. And I just want to trust local control on that issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlaw. Without any accountability, and with already having acknowledged that most districts are already doing this, what's the point of the legislation? I mean, if we're, you just indicated that you were going to trust the local school boards to do it, which you already acknowledged they're already doing. If we're going to pass state statute, shouldn't they be accountable to us then?
Representative Wardlaw.
If you want to, but I don't think it's necessary. I don't want to overburden them with paperwork going up to the Department of Education. I don't think it's necessary. And I think it raises a level of consciousness. It does force the discussion with the parent and the student about retention or at least change the way we're teaching them, and the parent's involved and finally finds out at some point that my kid's not doing this, this, and this, and this is what the school's doing to help change that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative.
All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Representative Wardlaw. This DE3 will be before us for consideration in the K-12 omnibus bill.
Thank you. And I'll bring apples if I remember.
All right. Apples are good for the memory, so. Representative Howes is up next, 2654. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is just going to be laid over for consideration, correct?
Yes. Would someone like to move this?
Maybe my good friend, Representative Biskins, could move it.
Madam Chair, it would be my pleasure.
All right. Representative Biskins moves House File 2654 to be before our committee for consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill would allow the Pillager School District to transfer $100,000 from its debt redemption fund to the general fund. There's currently a balance of $145,000. One of the reasons there's such a surplus there is that in 2002 and 2003, bonds were resold, and in 2002, the purchaser gave the district approximately $60,000 in lieu of interest rates.
I'm sorry, would you start over again?
Okay. Madam Chair, from the beginning?
No, just in lieu of, what was that about?
Oh, the district took the initiative to lower the pay 2004 levy for debt redemption by $60,000 after the district had received preliminary levy numbers from the state, and part of the reason for the large surplus is that the district resold bonds in 2002 and 2003. When the bonds were resold in 2002, the purchaser gave the district approximately $60,000 in lieu of lower interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The money would be used for three different items, and that would be ranked in the order of how they would use the funds if this is allowable. The first would be roof repair and HVAC repair and update to improve air quality in four elementary classrooms. That would be from $25,000 to $50,000. Number two would be to improve air quality in the kitchen cafeteria area by improving the HVAC system. That would be $25,000 to $50,000. And number three would be to improve handicap accessibility to the district office. Those estimates are between $10,000 and $20,000. A part of the cost would be reimbursable through the health and safety levy, but if the transfer is approved, the district would not levy these dollars. And I apologize that no one from my district was able to come down here today and really explain all this technical stuff. But they did want me to stress that this does not involve any state funds. In fact, the state may save a few dollars as the district does receive a small match on health and safety levy. And with that, I'd stand for questions.
Okay. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Howes, do you know how much of this money would be able to be captured through the health and safety levy? Do you have a dollar figure?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, unfortunately, no, they did not give me.
And I appreciate that. We can find out before we have to put together our omnibus bill. Madam Chair and Representative, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Howes. And if you don't know this, maybe we could ask Mr. Strom. But where would the $100,000 go if we don't approve this fund transfer?
Representative Howes.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, you probably already know the answer to that. I guess it would stay in the fund. I'm sorry, I'm not in education. That's not my arena.
Representative Howes, are your bonds for your buildings all paid off?
I'm not going to answer that without further information. I would guess no.
Okay.
But
because the excess that you're proposing to transfer, there is a requirement under law that the districts have an levy for more than what they need to pay off their bonds, and so you have kind of an excess there to, you know, for unanticipated problems with whatever, maybe higher something, I don't know. At the end of that payment of those bonds, whatever excess is left over is to be returned to the taxpayer. It's not supposed to be used for anything else. But we do occasionally have requests that if there's any leftover money, that be able to be used for it, and you're proposing, and you listed some of these uses. But we really would need to know how much the health and safety would cover some of these, and maybe health and safety would cover all of these situations, and you wouldn't even need to use your debt redemption excess, and you could return that to your voters. The other thing I was wondering, do you... how much do you have in your undesignated fund balance right now?
Madam Chair, you mean in this fund balance right now?
No, in your total undesignated fund balance for your school.
Unfortunately, Madam Chair, they did not give me that number either.
Okay, we would need that information too, because if you have a sizable fund balance, you might be able to use a portion of your fund balance. So I'd like to know what your undesignated fund balance is and what percentage of that is of your total operating revenues. So you, if you can get that information for us, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, I will do that.
Okay. Thank you. If there are no other questions of Representative Howes, we will have that information for the committee at a later time. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Our next bill is House File 2765, Representative Olson. While Representative Olson is coming up, who would like to move the minutes of March 16th?
So moved.
Who said that? Representative Johnson? Moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted, or the minutes are approved. Representative Olson? This was heard, I understand, in policy committee, so we don't need to go into a lot of details on this. We wanted just a quick review, please. And does this have a fiscal note? That's really why it's before us.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of an actual fiscal note stating that it will cost, because it's not a mandate. However, the reason why we felt we had to bring it to this committee is on page 3, section 3, where it authorizes a fund transfer from any fund or account if the district requesting the transfer demonstrates the commissioner's satisfaction that the fund or account has a surplus balance and the amount transferred will not negatively impact the curriculum and classroom instruction needs of the district. And, of course, it's being used, proposed to be used for the purposes stated in the bill, which is character development education.
Yes, now, Representative Olson, even though... The peanut gallery is a little squirrely today.
is squirrely one of the animals?
Yeah, yes, ma'am. I think there are some squirrels in there.
We need a little respect around here. So I'm going to have a little character education of myself here today. Thank you. Representative Olson, however, this language would require, because we would have no idea what funds these would be coming out of for a transfer. Could be from the debt. Could be from, you know, any number, the capital to, we don't know. It would be impossible for us to even, there would be a fiscal note at some point that would be credited to our committee. However, it's just so impossible to even anticipate it that I really think this is not a wise way to do this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Olson.
Just for time's sake, I'd be happy to address that.
Okay.
I appeal to the members of the policy committee, many of which are here and have heard this, to just leave it and bring it into this committee, because my appeal here is really to see, there's one part of the presentation we weren't able to emphasize in the policy committee, and that's the emphasis of savings that have actually been recorded in a number of cases. Now, I won't go through all the policy. We don't have everybody here that we had, and I'm sorry, Madam Chair, that you and a couple others on this committee were not able to hear the testimony in the policy committee that went very well, and we got a very good response to. But there's quite a history that is now developed with character education, and it is showing to be very fruitful in the area of academic gains in students, as well as behavioral disciplines developing and improving. And we have some statistics that I'd like to present, and if we need to strike that from the bill for the reasons you state, Madam Chair, that's perfectly fine. I understand that. I crafted it very broad because my appeal is, after you hear this testimony, is there a place we could come up with some funding that would be discretionary for and available through the commissioner for the districts that want to initiate this. This is permissive language. It's an encouragement. I found in my area there's a number of school districts that would like to do this, but they're afraid to do it. And so I was trying to provide the encouragement and possible financial support, and that's what really made them afraid to do it, is taking their resources and using it for this. They'd like to know that they have the state support. So that's what I'm trying to provide. And if I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to have Mike Bonema with us again from Making a Difference and Larry McGuire from Mark One, and they'll present some statistics and information on what they've found with their character programs that they've been working with.
And we do have limited time, so yeah. I'm going to stop you at 11, so that means you've got 10 minutes.
We're fine with that.
All right.
Hopefully be before that.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mike Bonema, and I am president of Making a Difference. That is a nonprofit organization designed to help raise funds for schools to be able to participate in a program called Changing Lives. I just want to take about 2 minutes to talk about the statistics, and I did this before, but just to talk about the research that validates that this program truly is transforming schools. One of the examples is Allen School in Ohio. It's an inner city school that, when Rudy Bernardo first started teaching there, had guards at every door. His first year, he had to suspend 150 different students, a total of 760 times. 5 years later, they only suspended 8 students for the entire year. They went, during that same time period, of being ranked number 28 out of 33 schools to number 1 academically. They went from the highest absentee rate to the lowest. They went from the lowest teacher morale to the highest during that time. In Georgia, we had some businesses that decided to fund schools, and after they had been doing this for a year, they decided to apply a Six Sigma study to determine if their investment in this school was paying off. The Six Sigma study is typically done in Fortune 500 businesses, and what they found was that in the junior high, they had a drop of 75% in discipline problems, 75%. In the high schools, 35 to 50% drop in disciplines. In Torrey Hill, in Michigan, we had a school that their first year of change of using this program, without any other changes, they broke the all-time record for grade point average for a school in the state of Michigan. The state of Texas is now giving students credit towards graduation for taking the Changing Lives program. They feel that it is that effective. All of these things took place without having to change teachers, without having to change administrators, without having to change classroom size or buildings or anything. It was just bringing back character. So that's one part of it. And then the second part is, what is it doing for these schools financially?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity. On the way down here, I was thinking about a book that I had read in last night on Built to Last, and it talked about the myths of business and things that lasted a long time. And I was reflecting on Mark just corrected me. I need to give my name. I'm Larry McGuire, thank you, from Mark 1, Litchfield, Minnesota. Reflecting on the myths that there are out there, and I was thinking about education sure has its myths, and we don't have time to go into that today. But what I would like to share very quickly is that we've learned a great deal. There's been a lot of research done in the last 5 years, particularly on this topic. And so the things that I'm going to share with you, I will mention that this newspaper was just printed yesterday, and it is available, and it has all the things I'm going to just make bullet statements but not defend at this point. They're in here, and all of the where it came from, and there is the research papers online to find it. So what I'll just make the statements at this point. But what we have learned in this process, which, as I mentioned, is verified by research, is that we do have great teachers and coaches and administrators and school boards, not the issue. What we've learned in this research in implementing the character education
that we have different students today than we had years ago, and there's a major shift in that. We needed to recognize that. Our youth, unfortunately, are lacking the the foundational character qualities needed to be in a culture and climate, and I underline those two words in our schools today, and that's probably true of our society as well. And that's what is leading, as research is showing, to the violence, the bullying, the drug and alcohol abuse, the discipline problems, and the don't care attitude that we're finding in the students. In fact, the lack of character basically is the issue in our countries. But I'd like to quickly jump to the results of some of these research projects and what has been happening. Frankly, we saw most of them, and some of them we did not see, which were pointed out to us. A comprehensive character education program dramatically changes, to the positive, that culture and climate, which is really a significant part of this. The comprehensive character education program lowers the violence, bullying, the drug abuse, the alcohol, and those things that we discussed, rather than just focusing on the violence as an issue or drugs. The character, in all the studies that we've had done, it automatically goes down with just focusing on the character issues. And I think that's an important one. And, of course, they have their cost as well. And I might add that all of the things you're going to see in the papers were all done with the same teachers. Not one school changed a teacher, a coach, an administrator, or any teaching methods. It was only what Mike referred to, the only changes that were there were putting in the character education. And that's a significant thing from that standpoint. I'll just make a statement. We won't talk about them, but it's only the foundational, universally accepted character qualities that need to be taught to have that success. So those distinctions in cultures or groups are not necessary to deal with. So you'll find that a good character program will have those issues. Just jumping from there right into the return on investment, something I have to say we did not look at till last summer, and it actually has shocked us. We got an email from a teacher and says, "Have you taken a look at the return on investment to our schools?" This was a gentleman from Minnesota. I said, "Frankly, no, we had not." So we started researching, and we looked at basically these areas: teacher substitute cost, student absenteeism, vandalism, the cost of discipline and suspensions, teacher replacement, alternative schools, parents that miss work. The list got to be quite long. The Boston Eagle reported last summer that the year before in Massachusetts, the school spent $108 million in substitute teacher costs, and it was attributed to the culture and climate. Was largely due to that cause that they referred to. There was many, many articles about that. Just two examples, and then I'll quit if there's any questions, but there's some real important ones, I think, to look at. And you'll see those numbers in the newspaper there because it is significant. Mr. Bernardo, who's the principal of the school that Mike mentioned a minute ago, reported a reduction in teacher substitute cost. It went from the year they started the program, and the only change they made in the school, now this is the school that had security guards, as he mentioned, was $208,000 a year for substitute teacher costs. And the only change they made was that. And at the end of the 5 years, not only there was not security guards, but they ended up between 10 and 14,000, or averaged about 11,000 a year in substitute teacher costs. And when you go through all of those costs that we mentioned above, the student absenteeism, the vandalism, and so forth, it's a significant number. It also mentions Bruce Revelle from Texas reported that just a 1% improvement in student attendance, because their schools are paid on the formula of attendance, not on enrollment, that was worth in Ector County $1.5 million a year annually, just raising the attendance of the student 1%. That's a large school, I grant. That's a 100,000 school, but if you apply that across our country, that's an unbelievable number. Mr. Bernardo's improved is that his attendance in that inner city school was 87%. At the end of the fifth year, it was 97. Just a brief comment about the Philippines. We put the program in the Philippines as well, and it's interesting that nothing changed because we didn't change any of the material. So it was culture relevant, it didn't matter, and they had the very same results there that we have here, and that's significant. So in closing, you say it certainly could be argued that the improved culture and climate of the teachers and students is certainly enough to support the effort, because we see such an improvement in grades automatically from this, but when you yield the or look at the tremendous return on investment to the families and the whole community, I think it's really a must to take a look at. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right. This has been heard in Policy Committee, and we have the discussion there. We have a question, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, it is to the financial aspect. I'm a big supporter of Character First Education, and someday if I have a chance to be a school principal, as if Mr. Meeks hasn't put me on a school board blacklist someday, I'd like to probably bring it in myself. But the question on the financial component, and it ties in a little bit with the last bit. I know that in some budget areas we allow an over levy to pay back bonds, etc. And maybe to Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, does the state calculate in the payback of the over levy as they look at tails and out years, or is the assumption that the over levy that we allow will always be used up?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and members, there is a calculation of the over levy, as you call it, in the tracking for the out years. So there is an assumption that part of that 5% over levy will be returned to the voters.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Olson, and then we must move on.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for committee reference, another amendment I had come up with just for discussion later, I anticipated the concerns that we might have to delete Section 3,
mm-hmm.
and I just want to leave the committee with this appeal to consider this other amendment for best practices grants also being able to be used for character education, because I think it does fit within that the context of what that's for. The violence prevention grants that are in the bill, I think most members probably know that the money for that has been zeroed out last year, but the policy language is still in statute, and so we'd still like to combine the character development education language with that in hopes that someday the money will be back for that. And there may be some federal money coming too, so subdivision 3 on the top of page 2, if we could keep that. I understand the issue with the fund transfer. And my hope was that maybe it would spark an idea that there'd be one fund that we'd allow a transfer out of, and just leave that as an idea. But if that has to be taken out, just simply having the encouragement there for school districts to do this, I think is worthwhile. And with that, Madam Chair, we'll also be handing out this periodical that Mr. McGuire mentioned, and leave it for members to peruse and see the benefits of character education.
Appreciate
thank
that.
You for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for coming again. The next bill on the agenda is Representative Johnson. And just a reminder, too, I'm trying to be consistent. There were two or three members that came to me, and I will say on my side of the aisle, with amendments that didn't make the 24-hour deadline. And I told them they could not present their amendments because they didn't make the 24-hour deadline. They can do that later at a time when we're doing our omnibus bill. But I want to make sure, just for fairness sake, that everybody has amendments that are timely. All right, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 2832 be passed and sent to the House General Register.
All right.
And I have an amendment as well.
All right.
I'd like to move the H2832A1 amendment.
All right.
And essentially that amendment, that's the only change to this bill from what we saw in the Policy Committee. This is the bill that requires public and school libraries to install Internet filters in order to receive state funding, and there's a provision for both the school section and the public library section that says that at the request of an adult who's conducting bona fide research, the district or the librarian must unblock the filtered sites without significant delay or question. The school boards raised, I think, a legitimate issue about that provision in the school section, saying, what about 18-year-old students because they are adults? So essentially, I've changed that language in the school section to be permissive, and it will say the district may unblock sites depending upon their policy. So that's my amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Any questions or about the A1 amendment? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, we've already discussed this bill at length in the policy committee. It provides that in order for public libraries or school libraries to receive state funding, they must install internet pornography filters. And I did not bring any witnesses today.
All right, you did not bring any witnesses. All right, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since the last hearing, I've been worrying about this bill because of, like I mentioned at the last hearing, the Arden Hills Library and the cost. I know because I'm active in the Friends of the Library, excuse me, that the members of that group from Arden Hills are very protective of that library, and the chair of the Ramsey County Library Board said during the hearing that this extra $40,000 to $80,000, I think the library administrator estimated
20 to 40.
Okay, thank you. This extra $20,000 to $40,000 would jeopardize that library. So I wanted to do all I could to make sure that we have the proper information so that we don't have some outcome like that we weren't intending. So I'm looking at the, since I am the ranking minority member of the committee, I would like to invoke Minnesota Statute 3.987, which is local impact notes for state mandated actions. And I know we don't use this one very often, but libraries are very important to me. And so I don't know if I need to make a motion, Madam Chair, or if I just now formally lay in my request, but I would like that information before we were you sending this to the omnibus bill?
To the House floor.
To the House floor. Well, then, Madam Chair, before it leaves the committee, I would use my ranking status to make that request.
I think, Representative Greiling, you can write a letter. And Mr. Crow is saying it has to be the ranking minority member of the tax committee.
Of the what committee?
Of the tax committee.
Madam Chair, let's see. I'm reading out of the statute I have before me. Before a committee hearing on a bill that seeks to impose program or financial mandates on political subdivisions, the chair or ranking minority member of the committee may request that the author must provide the committee with a note that gives appropriate responses to the following guidelines, and then it lists seven, including what funds are available for accomplishing this mandate. It doesn't say that it has to be the tax.
You're right. You're right.
Okay, and Madam
thinking,
Chair.
He was thinking if it would have been for schools, it would have been the tax, but
okay.
You're right.
And Madam Chair, it does not say it needs to be in writing. So I don't, you know, I could certainly write something out right now if that's your desire, but that's not part of the statute either.
Mr. Crow instructs me that the process that the Department of Finance wants is a letter in writing. That's what they want.
Okay, Madam Chair.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to be obstruction about this at all, Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
I am working on that letter. This wasn't on the agenda until just, you know, it kind of popped up here, so the timeline, I haven't got the letter completed yet.
Okay.
But I'm serving notice, so I think that that does meet the letter of the law, and it doesn't say anything in the statute about having to have it in a letter.
Madam Chair?
Representative Johnson.
I don't have a statute in front of me, nor have I ever heard of it before, because we've never used it before, but this bill does not impose a financial mandate on anyone. It says that a library board will look at how much this would cost their particular library, and it will cost every library a different amount of money, and then make a determination as to whether they are willing to forego state funds or not. So I don't think this imposes a financial mandate on anyone. Nor do I know how you could create a fiscal note, or whatever we would call it, to state what it's going to cost a particular library, because every system is going to be different.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will turn the letter in, and but Representative Johnson, if we had this law only apply if an unfunded mandate meant you could forego state funding, then this law would be meaningless. I am certain that that is not the intention of this law, and I would violently disagree with your interpretation. And I would be, I don't know if you were here when this passed or not, but if you had been, I'm certain you would have supported it. So now to be trying to, find a way not to follow it, I think is not what was intended here. I won't put any words in your motives there. But I'm serious about requesting this, and I hope you would be serious about wanting to know in these times of budgetary straits what you're doing with an unfunded mandate to a local government that impacts the very viability of a library that our community holds dear in my area.
Sure. Madam Chair?
Representative Johnson.
We actually did talk about that in the policy committee, and I believe the testimony of the technology expert that I had there was the cost is likely going to be somewhere between $20 and $45 per terminal, but it's going to depend upon what product you choose and how much you're willing to negotiate with the different providers. So you can certainly make an estimate on your own. The Hennepin County system estimated $32,000 is the absolute maximum that it would cost them. Most of the folks that I talk to that know this technology say that that's quite high, but nonetheless that was their estimate for system-wide 1,500 computer terminals. I have that in writing, and I don't know what percentage that is of their budget, but it's very, very small.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This law, though, does not require you and your testifiers to come up with the information. It is the Commissioner of Finance that we would get that information from, and that's what fiscal notes are. That's what local impact notes are. I believe this is a fairly new law, so we may not have used it before. It says for bills introduced after June 30th, 1997. So it's a law that I may or may not have even supported, but as long as it's there, I believe that I have the right to invoke it and have the law followed.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. I just don't think we want to make light of the fiscal struggles that our libraries are in or the fiscal impact of unfunded mandates on them. The Minneapolis library system has seen a significant retrenchment in its hours and services and acquisitions since the LGA cuts of last year, I think along the lines of a 25% cut in employees. The branch library in my neighborhood is now open strictly 40 hours a week. It's closed on Fridays. It's cut back acquisitions. It's cut back on staff. It's cut back on programming. They no longer offer some of the programs to attract preschoolers in and expose them to the library and reading and early literacy. They are operating on an absolute shoestring where people are, almost literally doing bake sales in the neighborhoods to try to keep some programming alive in the local library. And I don't think we should be callous and indifferent to the cost of an unfunded mandate on these libraries after we socked them in the stomach last year with significant budget cuts. I want to thank Representative Greiling for bringing forward the local impact note request, because I think it's appropriate for this committee to look at the impact of what it does on our communities.
And Representative Greiling is perfectly able to do that and request that financial note from the Department of Finance. From my own perspective, I think it is important that we do something for those preschool kids that we want in there, for the kindergarten, the elementary kids, that I would think with reduced staff, as the testimony was stated, that you have people running around constantly policing, which takes up a lot of staff time, and this would be a way of freeing up some of that staff time to serve their clients in a more efficient and better way. But we will certainly, you can certainly do that and have the note. We will still be considering this bill as it moves forward, and we'll wait for that fiscal note to come back from the Department of Finance. Thank you. We voted on the amendment, and this has been moved your bill has been moved to be before our committee for consideration, and we will just...
Actually, to pass to the House floor.
Or pass to the House floor, all right. We may need to go to Ways and Means. Well, I guess we really don't, unless there's a fiscal note that... Mr. Crow, what would be the... All right. Okay.
There's no fiscal impact to the state.
Right? All right. All right. There is no fiscal impact to the state, so we can go ahead and move it to the floor. Representative who? Who wants to talk? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a fiscal impact to the state. It doesn't have to be a negative impact. It could be a positive impact, too, but it says it withholds all state funds available to a school site, so that is a fiscal impact to the state. So I would say it should go to Ways and Means.
Representative Crowley.
Madam Chair, that would definitely be my preference because Mr. Crow, upon more reading of it, says that you were right in the first place. It sounds like where it does have to be the ranking member of either legislative tax committee. So I, only reading down in the second section where it says the chair or ranking member of the committee, I was thinking it was this committee. So I will now go and ask the ranking member of the tax committee to ask for this, and I'm sure we can get it. And then, so therefore, if it could go to the either the tax committee or the Ways and Means committee, but then it could be considered without, you know, having to be sent back when you get it on the floor. I think that would expedite the the process.
I think so too. All right, that's Representative fine. Johnson, I think it should go to Ways and
that's
Means.
Fine.
Okay. All right. So the motion is to refer this to Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The bill is passed and re-referred to Ways and Means. All right, the next one before us is Representative Latz. All right, Representative Lass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House File 2576. Perhaps as a co-author of the bill, Madam Chair, you'd like to move the bill for consideration, recommended to pass, be sent to the General Register on the floor.
All right. You want this sent to the General Register?
Yes.
All right. We can't do this because you've got this is a fiscal cost. You can't send it to the General Register.
Well, wherever it's supposed to go from here, then.
Yeah, it needs to stay here.
The fiscal. Okay. Well, the fiscal cost, our estimate is around $4,500 to $7,000.
Okay.
Need to stay here to be included in the omnibus bill. Okay. Then that's what we'd ask you to do.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, this is a bill to amend the state law so that schools that provide religious dietary food can cover the incremental or additional costs related to provision of that special food for low-income students. And what the bill does is it provides for a modest increase in the state reimbursement rate to schools that offer a free and reduced lunch program that meet the criteria for religious dietary food. This issue was brought to my attention by constituents in my district and the Jewish Community Relations Council, which represents a coalition of Jewish day schools in the Twin Cities metro area. To my knowledge, the bill would only apply directly to one specific school in my district, and their assessment, the school is Torah Academy, their assessment is that the cost difference is very minor, between $4,500 and $7,000 per year. So that it's quite clear what the intent of the bill is, it's only to cover the additional cost related to providing special religious dietary food. To that end, we do have an oral amendment to offer to the bill that clarifies that it is different than the bill summary that you have in front of you as well, which suggests that it's the full cost of the meals, and it's not the full cost of meals that we're seeking to deal with. The meals are currently subvented for free and reduced lunch by reimbursement from the state, and it's only the incremental cost related to the special dietary needs that we're seeking to add to that reimbursement.
So how do you want to change this?
Madam Chair, on page 1, line 16, the first word full should be deleted and replaced with the word additional. And on line 26, the word full should be deleted and replaced with the word additional. Madam Chair, this is the amendment that was made in the Senate committee this morning. So it both accomplishes the original intent of the bill and would conform it to the Senate version. I understand the Senate also laid over the bill to include in their omnibus budget bill, so the status would be consistent as well.
Okay. Representative Lass, it isn't your two clause twos are not consistent with one another. You're missing some language there.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Madam Chair.
Your two clause twos here are not consistent with one another. You're missing the free student lunch. And your second clause two, or breakfast, I mean. Reduced price and fully paid. Don't you want to have free in there, too?
You're right, Madam Chair. I'm glad you caught that.
Okay. Well, I didn't, Representative, or Mr. Crow did. I got to give credit where credit's due. Or Mr. Strom did.
well, whoever caught it,
we'll
thank
correct
you.
That.
We're
going to we'll
make that correction. Add that right. As an oral amendment. Appreciate that.
Okay.
I do have with me today a Rabbi Joel Waxman, a representative from Torah Academy, who can give more detail on why the bill is necessary.
All right. We need to, first of all, let's just get this language cleared up. We want to strike full and add additional, and then we also want on line 26 to put after the word each, put the word free, comma, reduced, priced, and fully paid. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right, now you can go ahead and talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Lass. The issue that we faced at Torah Academy was the following. We have a standard kind of lunch program for the children. We've got about 215 children. However, the children that make the greatest use of the program are those children from the lower income levels within our school. We've got approximately 40 children. 30 of them roughly seeking eligible for free lunch, another 10 eligible for reduced lunch. Our costs are approximately 30% higher for the kind of food that we have to prepare for these children at the school, the principal areas being the area of meat, cheese, and milk. We prepared a little table that identifies what the typical costs are throughout the state of Minnesota. It's identified as state reimbursement. It's not that. It's the state's, the typical average state cost for various portions of the lunch program and our costs. We're looking at a difference of $2.81 versus $2.15. We're not coming to the state to ask that they subsidize the cost for those children who can't afford to pay for lunch, but just for those children who cannot afford to pay for lunch, and that's an adjustment being made in the neighborhood of somewhere between $4,500 and $7,000 to the monies that we receive for our lunch program in the course of the year to cover for the additional costs that principally relate to the price of kosher food items of those types that I mentioned as opposed to the non-kosher.
All right, any questions? All right, and the cost, I have a question. This bill is drafted, you said, for this school, but what about any schools that have Muslim students or who have students that are, I mean, this applies statewide, so you could have other Jewish students that this would apply for. Is your fiscal note only for this particular school?
We do not have figures available to us as to what the population size and the need in the other schools. All that I can tell you is that our school has a relatively liberal admissions policy in that any parent who wishes their children admitted will have the children admitted if they meet the school standards, regardless of their ability to pay. So we wind up with a large proportion of lower-income students than do the other Jewish schools in the area. I'm not confident to speak on the issues of the Muslim community or perhaps the Hindu community, but this impacted us because of the larger number of lower-income students that we have.
All right. That's my concern about the fact that this is, you know, talking about your particular school, but we don't have any idea if we'd have Muslim students or we have Catholic students on Friday. This would impact a lot of religious groups, and I'm not sure we have a totally whole fiscal note here on this.
Madam Chair, perhaps for purposes of some guidance, analogously, nursing homes also get reimbursed at special rates in Minnesota relating to the special religious dietary needs. There are several Jewish nursing homes in the Twin Cities area which do get special reimbursement rates. I know it's not something that falls within the purview of this committee, but from a policy standpoint, the determination has already been made at a state level that it's an acceptable policy to apply. Mm-hmm. The bill is drafted in such a way so that it would not apply specifically to a Jewish day school, and yes, it would apply to other other religious schools that have special religious dietary needs that they meet for their student body. I don't know how we would. I'm not aware, and we're not aware of any particular need or concern that has been expressed by those schools to the extent that they exist. I'm not sure how we would put together financial analysis on that.
Once this is in law, I mean, then we have to pay for anyone who comes to a school with a religious request for some kind of dietary. And it's kind of hard for me to put my hands around what that impact might be in the future. Representative Goodwin.
Oh, Madam Chair, thank you. Would this also apply then to public schools that have children with special religious diets?
Yep.
So,
mm-hmm.
And I do have, we do, Connie and I have, Representative Bernardi and I have a Muslim school, an Islamic school in our district too, that I am 60% free and reduced lunches in that school district, so I assume that would apply to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Kramer,
I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
I do have someone else here who might be able to answer more specifically this question, I might, Madam Chair. Shep Harris from the Jewish Community Relations.
Mr. Harris.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. To more specifically answer your question, no schools have come forward. As the bill's been introduced, no schools have come forward to express any interest to us. We've had conversations with the Catholic Conference. And if there were any additional costs for their schools for fish on Fridays, it would be minuscule. That is the word that has been given to me. We're working with the department and as well as we'd work with the fiscal staff to see exactly how much cost this would be. They're revising the estimates because they were assuming, based on the bill, that the full cost of the meal would be paid, not the cost difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll have a better answer for you once that fiscal note comes forward. But as Representative Latz said, it is in statute, not specifically for Jewish homes, but for nursing homes that require special dietary need. And the cost increase has not been significant.
Okay. All right. Well, we will work with the Department of Finance and try to get something, more finite as far as what we're looking at here. So. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda, Representative Krinke is not here, so why don't we'll go ahead and move to House File 2820, and that's my bill. And there was an amendment that was not handed out in your packet. It should have been included in the packet, so that will be distributed. Members, this was a bill that we heard in policy. And Ms. Alney, if you want to just come down, I'm just going to do it from here. This is looking at our reading requirements for teachers, and right now teachers are able, or required actually, to go back and get some additional training in reading and as part of their continuing ed requirements. What we found is that requirement was very broad and was roping in people that had non-instructional duties and really don't need to do that. So first of all, I want you to look at the A2 amendment, and that is going to designate who is not required to do this extra reading continuing ed. And on the amendment on lines 6 through 9, it talks about librarians, counselors, school psychologists, school nurses, school social workers, audiovisual directors and coordinators, recreational personnel, media generalists, media supervisors, and speech therapists. So these people would not be required, and that has been worked out with Education Minnesota, the department, et cetera, to make sure that is clear going forward. And then the rest of the bill establishes and has, with the Board of Teaching, the ability to have a literacy specialist, and this would be someone who would have the ability to mentor and instruct other teachers in reading skills and be there as a resource person as well as a kind of the real expert in different settings. So I'd like to move the A2 amendment. Representative Greiling, do you have a question?
I just wanted to have some clarification on the 24-hour rule.
Yes.
It looks like this amendment was turned in this morning at 8:11, and there were some other amendments.
No, I apologize. I thought we had this one yesterday. Okay. We won't do it then.
Well, Madam Chair, that's not my point. I'm fine with doing it. I just wanted to...
I can't do that. I won't do that. Because I've already told three of my other members they didn't make the 24-hour rule. I'm not going to do it and make an exception for myself. So what we'll do is, this is before us. You'll look at the amendment, and we'll do it at a later date so that it's fair. I didn't realize the time. I thought we had this last night.
Okay. Madam Chair, I still have a clarification,
yes.
though.
Mm-hmm.
Because earlier there were other amendments, though, that were allowed that didn't make the 24-hour timeline, and so then you had said, there would be flexibility with that, and now today it sounds like you're enforcing it, you know, and I respect that for yourself as well. But I thought that it may be a moot point because we're only probably dealing with the omnibus bill now, and we don't have too many amendments before us. But I was thinking, I recall that you said earlier that there would be flexibility mm-hmm. with that for our side since your side got some in there that were mm-hmm. last minute. So I just wanted to make sure we maintain that flexibility should it come up, and it may not.
Yeah, and
even
let me tell you why I did it today. Because right at the last minute, I started having three and four different people coming up mm-hmm. and saying, oh, I've got another amendment. And at some point, it's not fair for the committee. Mm-hmm. We need to have our amendments before us. And I apologize. I really thought this amendment had been taken care of last night. I had seen the language, and I had signed off on it. And I didn't see the time. So I am going to hold myself to this rule. Mm-hmm. So today I said, no, that's enough. We can't, you know what the rule is, and we're not going to have this continual, you know, it's not fair to the committee members. You need to have your amendments ahead of time so that you can prepare for your own debate and information. So that's why I did it today. We will have that flexibility. We won't. For the omnibus bill, depending on when we get it out, and I also want to make the announcement, we will not be doing the omnibus bill on Tuesday. We will probably be doing it either on Wednesday or Thursday. So our targets have been postponed, I don't know when we're going to be doing it, but it should be. We still have to meet the 26th deadline, March 26th, but it's going to be moved probably at least a day later.
And
yes,
speaking of that, you know then when we are getting the targets.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I was just told that we weren't going to get them on Thursday. So, and just to sit tight. So that's what I'm doing. So anyway, I apologize, members. I did not see the timeline. I'm going to discipline myself to be fair to the committee. But this does correct some of the suggestions that were brought up in committee in the full policy. If you look on line 29, 21, I also want to bring out that there was some concern about that there are a lot of different kind of instructional methods, and so we wanted to clarify that at a minimum these things would be required, but if there are other things that come forth that would be important in the future, that the department or the Board of Teaching has the flexibility to look at those. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, one more deviation. We're trying to get straight in our caucus what night we should be saving for amendments. And we had saved Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to our staff before the committee, and now she was saying save Wednesday. But I wanted to just get straight. When are we getting the bill? Because now you said Tuesday or Wednesday.
Not Tuesday. We were going to have the bill on Tuesday.
Okay.
So it's definitely not going to be coming out on Tuesday. We hope it will be Wednesday. And I hopefully should know by the end of the week
if it's
going to be Wednesday. And we will try to give you the bill 24 hours in advance or as soon as we possibly can. So we try to give it to you. If we're going to do it Wednesday at 10, we'll try to get it to you by Tuesday at 10.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
If we're going to do it on Thursday, then it would be Wednesday at 10.
It would be the same process.
So we don't know if it will be Wednesday or Thursday.
I will let you know as soon as I can.
Thank you.
And hopefully it will be by the end of the week that we'll know. But I can't guarantee that because I don't know. You have to send in a good one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One final question on that. Then if we get it only 24 hours in advance, then how do we have time to do amendments?
Well, that's what we've always done.
So, in other words...
That's the rule that we've always had. We'll get you the bill.
We'll get the bill 24 hours in advance,
right.
But we have to have our amendments in 24 hours.
Well, that's
hours
where the time. Flexibility comes in. You're going to be able to have your amendments.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. Now, are there any other questions about this bill? Mr. Marcus, did you have a...
No question.
Okay. All right. All right. So now that we have a little chaos in our committee this morning, we will hold this bill over. We will have the amendment. It will be probably incorporated in our introduced again before we have the omnibus bill. So just but wanted to make sure that you all knew the changes that were coming forth. All right, next bill is House File 1792, which is the value added bill.
Really?
This amendment did make the deadline. Okay.
Sorry.
All right. We need some Ritalin, I think, over here today.
I think so, too.
Madam Chair?
Representative Greiling.
Well, where did Mr. Crow go? Apparently, Mr. Crow has another ruling on this, who turns in this letter. So could you ask him?
Representative Greiling, right now we're doing this bill. And as soon as we get this bill done, we'll get back to your issue.
Madam Chair, that will be fine.
All right. All right, this is a DE1 amendment. It's a delete all, and this did make the deadline, folks. We had some discussion about the value-added assessment, and basically we looked at and we've worked with Ms. Olson, who is the new assistant commissioner and is doing a lot of the, will be doing a lot of the oversight on the testing and assessment. I asked her to look at the old language, and we were concerned about the language that said not vertically scaled, and we took that to heart, and we've eliminated that. We've left in the other language that talked about, you know, the different kinds of classroom settings that you would want to make sure that you accounted for, and we also left in making sure that you could have a system that accounted for a portion of a student's scores or grading information, so that if you had some mobility issues, you still were accountable at least for part of, but also then took into account if they weren't here all that time, that you weren't held accountable or responsible for anything that, you know, you were not able to teach them. So it's kind of a... And then the other thing is on Clause C would be just the using the 16C02, the subdivision 4, the contracting process for an RFP to make sure that it's an open process and would be looking at the best value for this contract.
Madam Chair, Representative, the other big change in the language was to drop the word private that had been brought up previously,
right.
So that either a private or a public organization could submit a proposal.
Right, and then there was that one also.
Right.
Are there any other questions? Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, as you know, I'm generally been a strong supporter of trying to crowbar the department into going to a value-added approach.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns I have is my understanding is that it's the process isn't sufficient for the evaluation of teachers, that you really... It's more complex than that,
mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering if you would consider either now or as this moves along language that would explicitly state that this approach is not suitable for the evaluation of mm-hmm. teachers.
Yeah, actually, Representative Dabney, we were talking about that the other day, and I think we do need to make clear that the data would be private data in regard to teachers, and if maybe that's what you're talking about. And I would certainly be glad to entertain that motion. I think what we want to do is look at the value-added scores. We certainly want to track the kids individually, and each parent should be able to have the knowledge about how their child is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and then for the public data, it should be the aggregate classroom improvement. Any personal data about the teacher should be private and should only be used, I think, for instructional purposes and to inform the district of how that teacher mm-hmm. is doing, and that should be a private personnel issue and private improvement issue. So I'd certainly be glad to, maybe what we can do is work with Ms. Olson and you and myself and have some clarification of that going forward, because I think that has always been the intent. It's been my intent to work that way. So.
Thank you, ma'am.
Be glad to do that.
Appreciate it.
Okay, why don't we, you can get with us and our schedules later today. All right, are there any other suggestions, questions? All right, if not, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right, and then we will, Ms. Olson, you and I and others will get together and we'll try to craft some language pertaining to that.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm available anytime.
All right, thank you. All right, Representative Greiling, now back to your situation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apparently, Mr. Crow has a new interpretation, so I think we should get that from him so I can then make my request.
Okay.
Madam Chair, it's not a new interpretation, it's an addendum to my earlier statements. It is correct that if a member...
Did this addendum make the 24-hour?
It is correct that if a member wants a local impact note on a bill, that they need to request that the ranking minority member of the tax committee or the chair of the tax committee needs to make that request. However, there is a subdivision 2 in the local impact note section of law that refers to mandate explanations, which, as I understand it now, is what Representative Greiling, either in addition to a local impact note, wants, or in lieu of a local impact note, wants. But the mandate explanation requires that prior to a hearing on a bill, program or financial mandates on political subdivisions, the chair or ranking minority member of the committee, meaning this committee, or the committee the bill's in, may request that the author must provide the committee with a note that gives appropriate responses to the following guidelines, and there are 7 guidelines related to the imposition of the mandate that must be addressed prior to the committee hearing on that bill, and an objection to the hearing of a bill prior to having an explanation provided by the author of these guidelines listed in subdivision 2 would be in order in the committee that is scheduled to hear the bill.
So the author has to provide us with some information first.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Prior to the hearing of the bill.
Right.
Okay, and then so be put on notice what you're doing. Because this is the possibility that every single bill that has a local impact now in our school district will never be heard again. So the author has to do that, so we have to get that done. And then after that explanation, then the minority member or the majority member can request?
No, the chair or ranking minority member requests this information.
From the author. Okay.
The author mm-hmm. provides this information, and then the bill can be heard.
Okay.
And so Representative Greiling's motion to request that information...
Is that an order?
No, it was in order and should have superseded the hearing of the bill mm-hmm. under this section of statute.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So procedurally, you probably need to call the bill back
mm-hmm.
and then have the author complete the requirements that are outlined in this section,
mm-hmm.
in this subdivision.
Okay.
And then hear the bill again.
All right.
I think.
Well, I think what we need to do is perhaps talk with somebody who is more learned in, not that you aren't more learned, but looking at the process of how this has happened, since we've already heard the bill and there was no objection raised until after the bill was heard. You don't think so, Representative Greiling?
Madam Chair, I raised this issue sooner, and like I said also...
You didn't raise it in policy. Representative
Greiling. No, it was here today.
Yeah.
And, Madam Chair, also, it was my intention to actually write a letter sooner, but
mm-hmm.
this item was, we didn't even see this on the agenda. I don't know when it was added exactly.
Well, it's been on the agenda for...
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Question for Mr. Crow, Madam Chair. Does the statute tell us when and how this request is to be made?
Madam Chair... members, the statute says before a committee hearing on a bill that seeks to impose program or financial mandates. So that's the when. And the how, it just says that the chair or ranking minority member of the committee may request that the author must provide the committee with a note that gives appropriate responses to the following guidelines. So it doesn't say in writing or via motion or... It doesn't specify how that has to happen, but it does say that that the author then provides that information to the committee.
Okay, so we have a two-pronged approach here. Representative Johnson needs to respond to the 7 points in this law, and Representative Greiling is going to be having the tax minority.
No. This doesn't require
this. Doesn't require that. Okay, that
member,
was clarified.
The minority ranking member of
okay.
any committee that
our,
the bill
our
is
majority member.
Or the chair.
Yeah, mm-hmm. or the chair, okay. So we'll have that going on at the same time. So we will have to pull back the bill from Ways and Means and have it stay here. So we'll move to reconsider
whereby the bill was passed.
House File 2832, whereby it was passed, and we want to bring it back here to our committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition? All right, that motion has been approved. So, Representative Johnson, you now have to follow this process.
What's the statute number? I can go do that in a few minutes.
Okay. All right, now then, we need to move on. We have one more bill. Is Representative Krinke. And then that should bring us just about to the hour of...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1109 for possible consideration in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
All right. Do you have any testifiers? This bill was heard last year. It was put in our Omnibus Bill last year. Representative Krinke was requesting another hearing for this and an opportunity to have this heard again. Do you have testifiers?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe we have some people here from
okay.
the Minnesota Business Partnership that would like to offer just a brief comment. While they're coming up, members, this bill did receive a rather extensive hearing in this committee last year. It was included in the omnibus bill, but did not reach consensus in the conference committee. Therefore, I would beg the committee's indulgence again to include this provision. I think it's extremely important for all of our school districts around the state to have a clarification that they indeed are the ultimate contracting authority and that they have the right to unilaterally contract for services other than, obviously, that of licensed teachers. With that, I'll let the witness comment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
In looking at the bill and remembering last year's discussion, this appears to me to be a significant change in PELRA, and as such, not an appropriate candidate for inclusion in the omnibus bill. And because of that, I would make a motion to re-refer this bill to the Committee on Jobs, Commerce, and Economic Development, who I believe has oversight over the PELRA provisions and state statutes.
All right. There is a move to re-refer this to Jobs and Economic Development.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I'd ask for a roll call.
All right. Roll call vote is being requested.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krenke.
I don't believe that Jobs and Economic Development has any purview over PELRA whatsoever.
All right.
My apologies, Madam Chair. Government Operations Representative Krenke would have purview over PELRA? Yes. Let me clarify the motion and correct it to re-refer the bill to the Government Operations Committee.
All right.
Out of respect for the chair there.
All right. Representative Krenke?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, this, as I said, was included in last year's bill, number one. Number two, I do not believe that this is a substantive change in PELRA whatsoever. I would be happy to talk to the chair of the Government Operations Committee and find out if he has any desire to see the bill or to it. The purview of Government Operations is that if you are making setting up a new government entity, if you are removing a government entity, those types of government structure, this is a clarification, as we went through last year, a clarification of who has unilateral contracting authority. And as I said, for those people who want to say a substantive change, it is not. That authority rests with the district, and this is a clarification so that contracts can get a termination point. At some point, the mediation ends, and the board has the authority to continue to operate the services within the district.
Representative Biskins, you want to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question procedurally. When a bill is heard in committee and is not moved into law or even into an omnibus finance bill, it was always my understanding that at the end of the first year of a biennium, the bill returned to the committee of last destination. So technically, this bill already is in the purview of this committee,
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. And Representative Dabney, however, is seeking to send it to another committee, and that's what the discussion is about. Representative Krenke.
But Madam Chair, just let me also point out to members that this is a change to Section 123B.02, which is entitled Independent School Districts. General powers of independent school districts. So if it doesn't belong here, Madam Chair, I have no idea where it does belong.
All right. It's not part of the power, isn't what you're saying. It's not part of the power law. Representative Goodwin.
Oh, Madam Chair and Representative Krenke, most all bills that go before the legislature that have to anything to do with contracting or changes to current processes in labor law go before the Government Operations Committee. This certainly, to me, is the thing to do. So I support Representative Dabney's motion to send it to Government Operations.
Representative Krenke, did not it go before them last year?
No,
didn't you go
Chair.
Through all of the hoops last year?
No, Madam Chair, as I said, this bill was heard in this committee and considered it the reason that it has a according to the discussion we just had, this would have a generally have a or could have I won't say it does have it, it could have a positive fiscal impact to independent school districts.
All right, well, let's go ahead and have the testimony, Representative.
We have a motion, I believe.
We have a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we have session at noon.
All right, the motion has been made to refer this to GovOps. You want to call the roll?
Representative Johnson?
No.
Abler? Bernardi?
Yes.
Unap?
Yes.
Biskins?
No.
Dabney?
Yes.
Demmer?
No.
Eakin? Not here. Erickson?
Yep. Hi. No.
Goodwin?
Yes.
Greiling?
Yes.
Eisgutken?
No.
Clemson? Krinke?
No.
Mariani?
Yes.
Newman?
No.
Olson?
No.
Slawick?
Yes.
Sikora?
No.
Wardlow? Segrin?
No.
The total is 7 yes, 11 no, and 3 absent.
All right. The motion is not approved. All right. Representative Krinke, you have some testifiers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. In the interest of time, I'll keep it short. The Business Partnership does support House File 1109. We do so as a means of giving local school boards greater flexibility to provide the best, most efficient services possible. For example, if a local school board determines it can improve service or save money by contracting out some or all of their payroll functions, as an example, the board could then reallocate those savings to student instruction, to teachers. This creates a win-win situation for the kids in the classroom as well as the district as a whole. House File 1109, again, will give local school boards the added flexibility they need to maximize their resources. And for this reason, we would encourage you to adopt House File 1109.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And because our time is short, we've had one for, I'd like to bring one against up. Ms. Bordelon, we'll bring you back after session. Who would like to go up? We've got Ms. Alzweiger, Ms. Beckman, or Mr. Cowan, or Chris Cowan. One, quickly. Thank you. Welcome, and identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Beckman, and I'm with the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and we represent about 9,000 workers in public school districts across the state, in Local 23, Local 63, and 284. We object to this bill for four reasons. First of all, House File 1109 interferes with local control in school districts. School districts and their employees should be able to negotiate employment agreements at their local bargaining table without interference from the state. Number two, House File 1109 is unnecessary. School districts are already able to privatize public school services. For example, 60% of all bus pupil transportation in the state is outsourced to private for-profit companies. School districts do not need this bill to outsource contracts. Number three, House File 1109 is union busting. There is no provision in this bill that requires the employer to come to the table in good faith within 45 days' time. Administrators could stall and with the specific intent of busting the union, and we object to that being a policy of the state. Number four, House File 1109 speeds up the process of funneling taxpayer dollars meant for our public schools to for-profit companies. For example, I live in St. Paul, where First Student is the primary provider for school bus transportation. And First Student is a subsidiary of the international conglomerate based in the United Kingdom. Looking at their books, you can see that this UK company makes millions of dollars in profit from their North American pupil transportation. As a taxpayer in St. Paul, I object to my resources being funneled to the schools, out of the schools, out of my community, in fact, out of the country, rather than being spent on public employees and public schools. But that's a bigger conversation about privatization in general. SEIU shares Representative Krinke and the business partnership's concerns for accountability and efficiency in public schools. However, we don't agree to their means to get to this goal. We don't believe school districts are well served by the state having an unnecessary law that interferes with local control and bus unions. We hope you will agree with us and AFSCME and the AFL-CIO and Education Minnesota in our opposition to this bill, and we would ask that you not include it in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we are going to be recessing to the 4:30 in room 5, and we will finish up with the testifiers on this bill at that time. This meeting is recessed.